I've been here at Oxford for almost a month, and it's been really wonderful seeing a number of old friends, making a number of new friends. I'm grateful to John, to all the postdocs, to Rachel, and to the John Templeton Foundation for making all this possible. My comments are on Laura Callahan's excellent paper, Limits on Religious Testimony, Lessons for Morality. She focuses on three cases to orient her discussion. The first case of testimony is where Alex needs to know how much he owes for his taxes, and so he asks the specialist to give him an answer. He believes the specialist's answer, and he comes to accept it on the basis of testimony. That's the first case, a garden variety case of belief based on testimony that seems perfectly fine. The second kind of case, though, is a case of moral testimony. Bill is worried whether lying by omission is morally permissible or morally wrong. And so he asks a friend who he thinks is an expert on such topics. The friend says, yes, indeed, lying by omission is wrong. He believes the testimony. Third, Cora is worried about the existence of God, worried that perhaps she doesn't know or have good reason to believe in the existence of God, and so asks someone who she thinks is a religious expert. The expert replies, yes, indeed, God does exist, and so she comes to believe in God's existence on the basis of testimony. So we have three cases, garden variety testimony, testimony about morality, and testimony about religion. The main issue of the paper is whether there's some strong analogy between doubts about moral testimony and so doubts about religious testimony. So first of all, thinking about one and two, garden variety and moral testimony, ordinary testimony is fine. Simply believing what someone tells you about your taxes, especially if they're an expert and so on, that seems perfectly fine. Or even some small mundane thing like the direction towards Summertown seems fine. But moral testimony, a number of authors have found doubtful or suspicious. So there's a contrast, many people think, between one and two. One possible explanation for the contrast that there's something fine about accepting reports about how to get to Summertown, but something suspicious about simply believing what people tell you on the basis of testimony, is a special norm explanation. That when it comes to moral testimony, something else is required of the recipient. So this is something Allison, for example, and a number of others have pursued. What Laura wants to know is whether there's a similar kind of norm in the case of religious testimony. So again, ordinary testimony would be fine, but religious testimony, that might be suspicious. So perhaps just as there's a special norm when it comes to accepting testimony about morality, so too there's a special norm for accepting testimony about religious matters. So that's the main issue of the paper. The first key idea when focusing on the moral case involves pure testimonial deference. Pure testimonial deference is when someone tells you something and you accept it. Now you check it to see if it's crazy or if this person isn't trustworthy, but once you've checked for that, you just accept it and you don't reflect on it. You, as it were, put it in a box on your shelf. It's just something that you believe that goes into your belief box, but you don't do much with it. It's a pure kind of deference, pure testimonial acceptance. That's the first idea. That sometimes happens. So that would be acceptance without further reflection. The second key idea is full understanding. So we've got pure deference on the one hand, now we're going to have full understanding on the other. Now full understanding is when you've got a subject matter where you've got some knowledge about it. You can reason from one proposition in the subject matter to another, and you can see the connections between those propositions, those things that you know. It involves effective responses, so the emotions are often involved. So if it's a case of morality, for example, and you think lying by omission is wrong, you might be able to give reasons for thinking that it's wrong, why it's not as bad as other forms of lying. And if you see someone do it, you might get upset about it. If you find that you're doing it yourself later on, you might feel guilty. And knowing that lying by omission is wrong might motivate you to do a number of things. So you've got an understanding of why lying by omission is wrong, an understanding of morality. When you've got a number of features, knowledge, reasoning between various propositions in the subject matter, the right kinds of emotional responses, you're motivated to act in a variety of ways. That's what goes on when you really understand morality. That's the second key idea. We've got a contrast now between pure deference, you believe something, you put it in a box, it's reasonable to believe, and then full understanding, where not a lot is involved. The third key idea is that when it comes to morality, in particular, it's important that you understand morality. Moral understanding is so useful and essential for the important human endeavor of morality. So simply knowing that something is right or wrong, that's often not enough for what's really important about morality. We're moral beings. Throughout our entire lives, we need to make a number of important decisions, and we need to understand the reasons for those. So to grow into a complete moral person is very important for our lives, both instrumentally, not getting into trouble, helping other people along, and so on, and for its own sake. It's intrinsically valuable. So the first key idea, pure deference. The second, understanding. And third, the importance of understanding when it comes to morality. So now it's the fourth key idea, in a way, the main argumentative idea, that pure deference is a pro tanto bad. What it does is it squeezes out understanding. So remember how we were understanding pure deference. That's sort of, someone tells you something, you check it, it's not crazy, they're not crazy, reasonable to believe, you put it in your box, it's something you might know, but because you're not incorporating it with all these other things that you know, you're not using it as a reason or understanding the reasons for it, you're not engaging it with motivations and your emotional life, it's sort of squeezing out all of those other things that are important. And so when it comes to testimony, because understanding is so important, there's a special norm. Don't simply rely on testimony, but when someone tells you something, realize that's second best. You often need much more in order to get what's truly important about morality and moral knowledge. So there's a special norm for the case of testimony. That's the main setup of the paper, taking some work from a number of people who've thought about what might be suspicious about moral testimony, seeing the overall form of why it might be suspicious, and then asking whether the same kind of case could be made for religion, for religious testimony. So here's how it goes for the religious case. Again, the first idea is pure deference. Suppose someone tells you something, maybe God exists or Jesus died for our sins, something with religious content or relevant to religion, and you just think, well, they're not crazy, they seem to know what they're talking about. I've thought about this a little bit, and that seems reasonable, and then you put it in a box. It's just something you know it through testimony, suppose. But then there's the second idea, full understanding. Full understanding is when you sort of see the reasons for and against, it connects with your motivations, with your emotional life and so on, you're able to explain it, to justify it to other people, you're able to extend it to other areas. Full understanding of religion would be much better. So the third idea is when it comes to understanding, there's the general importance of it, especially in the religious case. So once you get the squeeze involved, if you're just taking what other people tell you, and you're not incorporating into other things that you believe, into other things you give reasons for, to your emotional life and so on, then you're lacking out on what's really important, the importance of understanding in the religious life. So too then there would be a special norm for religious testimony, where religious testimony in a way would be second best, a pro tanto bad, even if it could give you knowledge. So that's the overall analogy between the moral case and the religious case that Laura argues for in her paper. So here's a quote that gives you a feel for her conclusion. Surely, if there is religious truth to bother about, our emotional and motivational involvement with it is extremely valuable, the value of full understanding. To put this another way, religious truths are not merely facts to be collected, not merely facts to learn through testimony and put on a shelf. They call out for acceptance with what we might think of as Kierkegaard's subjectivity, a kind of deeply personal, emotional involvement with truths that is ongoing and calls for one's own action and decision with respect to that relationship. So that's Laura's case for thinking there's a special norm in the religious case, just as there's a special norm in the moral case, because full understanding is so important, and it's not something that you get. Indeed, it's something that might be squeezed out by pure deference. So even if you can get knowledge through testimony in these domains, it's a pro tanto bad, it's second best. Well, I have a few comments I want to make. So this is the critical comment part. First, it's often remarked that testimony stinks when people write their papers on testimony, and they often begin with quotes from Plato, sort of authorities who have said, you know, I've smelled testimony and you don't want to know what I thought about it. And one comes from Plato. There's actually a paper from Miles Bernier, I think it's called Socrates and the Jury, that it says, you know, that of all the horrible ways to form beliefs, relying on testimony must be the worst, something to that extent. And here he's doing some interpretation of Plato. There's also that quote everyone likes to use from the beginning of Locke's essay, where Locke says something like, you know, if something might be, you know, creme brulee in someone else's mind, and they just tell it to you, then it's but, you know, Twinkies or fairy dust or something. That everyone knows that quote. What is it? Gold and dust. Right?
It's in
Locke. Twinkies. British cuisine. So, in both of these cases, I think the interpretation is sort of importantly mistaken. Because the way we think of knowledge today, knowledge is not nearly as demanding as it is in Locke, and probably not as demanding as it was in Plato. And most sort of more nuanced translations of the Plato case are actually thinking of understanding, that you can't get understanding through testimony. It's not that you can't get knowledge through testimony. So the way Plato's making the same kind of point that's being made by Laura and others, that testimony often falls short of something that's very important, either epistemically or for some other sort of aspects of our lives. So Plato himself isn't really against testimony per se, but again, it's not going to give you enough to give you the kind of understanding which is important in the moral life. And then in Locke's case, Locke is actually talking about knowledge in his sense. Knowledge, his sense, is the perceived agreement and disagreement among ideas. So you give me some mathematical thing and you understand it, you see why it's true, then you've got knowledge. Now, if I just tell it to you, and you don't have the understanding sufficient to perceive the agreement or disagreement among ideas, then of course you won't have knowledge. So it's sort of trivial on Locke's view about what knowledge requires, that you're not going to get knowledge from testimony. At best, you'll get what he calls probable opinion. And probable opinion is what we now, in general, think is enough for knowledge. So on Locke's sort of official view, translated to contemporary English, there's nothing really wrong with testimony. So Plato's not against testimony, but he agrees that it falls short of understanding. Locke is not against testimony for conveying knowledge, but again, he agrees it falls short of something, namely the perceived agreement or disagreement among ideas. The next point I want to make is, in the kind of argument where we're looking for a kind of special norm, is this really a special norm on testimony? Is testimony really at fault? Does testimony really squeeze out understanding? So when I was walking over with Sandy this morning, I was sort of thinking about this. It's like, well, how could testimony squeeze out understanding? Suppose you're a physicist and you're at a physics conference and someone's about to make a presentation and tell you their results. You say, whoa, stop. I want to understand this. And if you just tell me, it's going to squeeze out understanding. Right? So really what's objectionable is the failure to strive to understand. So believing other people is often a scaffold. It's a way we sort of build up to an understanding. This is also very important in the moral case, and certainly true in the religious case as well, and all sorts of other cases where we have understanding of a subject matter. We start by relying on other people, and then we build up our own understanding. And so part of our pedagogy, and this is a point that Laura emphasizes, is a part of good pedagogy is to help get people towards understanding. So the person who says, I've been told, I don't need to do anything more, that's the mistake. The norm is on sort of refusal to grow in an area, not on the unacceptance of testimony. So I don't see that it squeezes out. I see that testimony is not enough, but I don't see that testimony is a bad thing in itself. Last point. I think what Laura's onto is a general point. It's not just about morality, it's not just about religion. But for any important domain in our lives, we need more than a bunch of propositional knowledge. We need to see the connection between the things we know, we need to be able to give reasons for them, we need what Allison described as cognitive command. All of those are important, and because we're deeply emotional beings, it needs to be integrated in the right way with our emotional life and our motivations for any important domain. So morality is universal, which explains the interest, and maybe religion too.
Religion.
It's a different word. That's right. I put it up in Dutch. So. Laura mentions a case in passing from Anscombe, that Anscombe was making a similar kind of case for mathematics. You don't simply give people a bunch of knowledge of theorems or axioms. They've got to be able to draw out more theorems, get an understanding of why they're true. And oftentimes, even in education, the teacher who's able to explain to us why the rule is true so that you can kind of derive the rule on your own is a much better teacher than one who simply tells you the rule and helps you apply it to cases. Music, an example from Ryle. So if you're a violin player, or you play the piano, or you're interested in opera, there's a lot more involved than simply being told a number of facts. I was actually thinking, since we're all watching the World Cup, this will all be famous for this example now, sport. If you're a coach, right, simply reading a book on soccer or football, that's not going to be enough for you to be a really good coach, to make new decisions, new strategies, to adapt when a player's injured and so on, to have the right kinds of motivations and emotional responses. That's all very important to being a successful, flourishing coach or player. Goldberg.
That's an ugly one.
Another very good example. So I think it's a general point. So I want to conclude my comments with one very sort of brief remark about a domain that's important to all of us and important to me. This kind of point that testimony is often not enough, I don't think we reflect on it enough as a profession, not just philosophy, but I think higher education in general, when we go for the method of lecturing in our classes. Lecturing is a very effective means to transfer information, to get a bunch of propositional knowledge in someone else's mind, at least for a short period of time, if they're able to pay attention for more than 15 minutes. But it's not a very good means to get the kind of understanding that we value in our own lives, in the lives of our students, the lives of our peers. So insofar as we're sort of passionate about helping our students understand, we need to think about that kind of pedagogy that goes from testimony towards understanding. Right. Thank you.
That was a very clear and faithful reconstruction of the main ideas in the paper, so thank you. And also thank you to the John Templeton Foundation and the conference. I'm really grateful for this opportunity to hear your feedback and reactions, so this is great. I definitely need to think more about some of Peter's suggestions and questions. I like the idea that I'm following the same line as Plato and Locke. That seems good. But I'll just give some first pass thoughts here, picking up on a few of the items that he raised. One point of clarification. So in the paper, I argue that there's a norm requiring us to understand our moral beliefs. Not straightforwardly a norm requiring us not to take beliefs on testimony. That's sort of derivative. So then I go on to argue that pure deference to testimony is in tension with or at odds with the development of understanding, and that this underwrites our pessimist intuitions and conclusions about moral testimony. But this touches on your question whether it's really testimony that's at fault or whether the real problem is in the knowledge without understanding and the kind of stopping there. I think that's right. I think it's the knowledge without understanding and the stopping there, in particular domains, that is problematic. But if, as I've argued, pure deference to testimony is a method of learning or belief formation that's in tension with developing understanding, we can diagnose the root of some problematic, moral knowledge unaccompanied by understanding by pointing to the way that the belief was formed. And we can endorse general prohibitions, like the pessimist intuition, on simply deferring to others' testimony in certain domains. And in the moral case, so I thought about this a little bit. Where do you get knowledge without understanding? Is it always from testimony, or are there other sort of common methods by which we arrive at this kind of problematic state? And I think that in the moral case, if you're thinking about everyday methods of belief formation, so not thinking about oracles or magic pills, it seems like, there's reflection, and there's response that's maybe more or less sort of reflective and thoughtful, but a response to moral reasons. And then there's testimony, and those are kind of the routes that are on offer. And it seems to me that testimony stands out as the sort of primary or sole culprit in the creating the condition of knowledge without understanding that's problematic in the moral piece. So be grateful for more thoughts on that. But second, so I want to briefly defend or explain how I'm thinking about testimony squeezing out understanding. And my first thought is, I think there's kind of two ways in which this squeeze happens. And the first is that, you know, merely deferring to testimony sort of prevents the cultivation of our capacity for moral religious understanding over time. So the ability to understand moral propositions and understand them in new and changing situations and form them is the kind of ability that can be strengthened or weakened over time through use or misuse or neglect. You know, if I'm always just, every time I face a moral question, you know, I just call my mom. Like, I don't think that I'm gonna get good at responding to moral reasons. I don't think I'm gonna develop the ability to understand moral truths when I'm in a situation where I need to. So second, I do think that deferring to testimony in a particular instance, we can make sense of that squeezing out understanding of the proposition at hand as well. I'm less sure about this, but I think it could happen in either or both of two ways. So first, you might think that, you know, knowledge without understanding of a moral proposition genuinely gives us some of what we want out of a cognitive grasp of that proposition. It could, you know, help us answer, act rightly on a particular occasion. You know, it's good in general to know things. I'm not saying it's not good to have moral knowledge. It's just better, and it's what we want. It's what's necessary to have a fuller moral understanding. So my idea is that, you know, if you've got two people, one who knows but doesn't understand P, and one who just doesn't know or understand P, and there's some effort involved in coming to understand P that would, you know, if you took it, you would also get to know P, let's assume, if you didn't already. But we've got these two people, and both people have other sort of competing pressures on time and attention. All things considered, I think it's gonna be rational in more cases for the second person who neither knows nor understands to go to the work of understanding than the first person. And that's simply because the second person gets a bigger boost from the same work. So this is sort of, I guess, a standard, you know, pretty good is the enemy of excellence kind of thought. And I think there's a slightly different way this could go. Knowledge without understanding could just be deceptive. It could give you the false impression that you've got everything you want, that you've got everything you need. And this is perhaps especially true in societies where education emphasizes sort of acquiring information versus developing critical reflection. And third, I just want to, you know, pick up on and endorse this idea that this generalizes across domains. I think a really interesting case, I'll put, you know, Callahan on another one of those, for those of us in this room, is philosophical knowledge. So I oughtn't to defer to others about my opinions in epistemology. You know, even the august people in this room, right, who I do take to be, to some extent, you know, authorities on this topic. Even if all of you agree, right? I think that too late. Even in the very, you know, far-fetched hypothetical scenario where you all agree about something in epistemology, right? I think even then I shouldn't just defer. And you know, it's an interesting question whether that's sort of, you know, about philosophy as a domain, you know, this is the kind of question that I oughtn't to defer about, or whether that's about my role as a, you know, philosopher. It's because I'm purporting to be a person who does this, who's an expert in this, that I, in particular, oughtn't to stop at just deferring. You know, think of the tax expert, even in the first example. So it's plausibly okay, if this is, you know, the case where Alex asks somebody how much he owes in taxes. Seems fine for Alex to defer and to sort of take it on testimony, but maybe we want to say that the person, the tax expert, whose job it is shouldn't just defer to somebody else, or that at some point that chain has to stop, right? Somebody has to not only know what outsources and taxes, but understand to some extent why. So one way to put this general thought would be that belief in particular propositions might not simply aim at knowledge of those propositions. It might aim at something more, at understanding for particular propositions. And there might be really significant variation in the degree of understanding that's aimed at, variation that could be pretty radically contextual, depending not only on the specific proposition, the specific agent or circumstances. So this is definitely stretching well beyond what I've argued in the paper, but I do agree with Peter that the moral and religious domains don't feel like sort of one-off anomalies, and thinking that they are actually seems like a harder, sort of more ad hoc claim to support. If we see this as part of a general phenomenon, it at least seems to make a little bit more sense than we would expect. So, thank you.
Questions? Keep your hands up till I give you a knowing way of calling them.
Okay, so I had a question. Well, I have loads of questions. Let me just pick one. So this is following up on Peter's comment as to whether testimony is at fault or whether there's something about the agents, something else about the agent that's at fault. And it strikes me that the way you actually present the case, you present the vignettes at the beginning, suggests it, like a much more plausible diagnosis is that there's something about the agent's motivation that's at fault than with the end epistemic state. Here's what. So you start off with the case, so you bring the case of Alex with taxes, Bill with the moral stuff, and Cora with God. Mm-hmm. Okay, so why do we ask tax experts for tax advice? Well, it's just like, we have like absolutely no interest whatsoever in taxes. Like, we seek out an expert because we want to avoid any kind of thinking about it, anything to do with it. And it's purely a means to an end. Like, we want to get the taxes right in order to not be punished, in order to save, maximize our money saving, but like, there's no interest in getting it right for its own sake. And you might think that if this is how we're then invited to read the case of Bill, who asks for moral advice, not because he's interested in doing what's right for its own sake, but just because, maybe he has to fill in a crossword puzzle that asks him whether lying by omission is a problem or not.
Yeah.
Or, and similarly, if Cora is like taking part in a pop quiz or whatever that asks whether there's a God or not, yeah, sure, there's something like fishy about Cora and Bill, but it's not the end belief that they end up with. It's the fact that the motivation for seeking out expert advice is kind of incompatible with how we conceive of a morally ideal agent or of like a genuinely religious person, you know?
Yeah, that's really interesting. I mean, so I guess one question is, I didn't specify the motivations in the paper, and we might think that we might impute to Bill and Cora these kinds of motivations, or think your suggestion was that it's natural to read them as having sort of core motivations in trying to answer the question. I guess I'm wondering why we think that their motivations would be poor just because they're seeking to answer these questions by testimony. If you thought that looking to answer these things by asking somebody was a sign of being badly motivated, that itself kind of raises a question. Okay, why is that not a, why is asking, looking for testimony the sign of a badly motivated desire for truth?
Well, it's both things. I mean, it's the juxtaposition with the tax case, which is supposed to, because you're trying to get an asymmetry.
Yeah,
and in
right.
most cases, I mean, virtually all cases that I've seen in the literature that try to get the asymmetry going, they present a non-moral case where you just meet the true information as a means to some other end.
Mm.
I think if you specify, so there are two ways of testing this, and maybe that's something to do. One thing would be to fill in that Alex is genuinely passionate about taxes, And he really, you know, he's trying to get true beliefs about it, and that's, and kind of fill this in with the Bill case and the Cora case as well. Or do something where you hold fixed, where it's explicit that the motivations between the non-moral case and the moral case are held fixed.
Yeah. Yeah, thank you. I'll have to think more about that. I mean, I think that if it comes down to saying something like, you know, we need to be motivated to understand moral truths, and that, you know, we look for that as sort of, you know, a condition on being a morally good agent, I think that in itself suggests the kind of value for moral understanding that I would like to say there is. But
right, but it might be just we need to be motivated to know what's true for its own sake.
Yeah,
sure.
I'll just be more about that. Thank you.
Now, Christina. Okay.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
So one thing that struck me about the discussion is something I think maybe unique in certain ways and not in others to the case of religious testimony in particular. And it echoes some of what Paulina was saying, but there are of course really different traditions about how you accept testimony, the role testimony plays within, say, the Catholic or Orthodox and Protestant traditions. And one thing you don't talk about at all is the idea of sort of communal knowledge and the role that that can play here. Mm-hmm. And it struck me that, at least in the case of religious testimony, you're missing something that's really important if you're thinking about it purely in terms of, oh, I ask Paulina whether God exists, Paulina says yes, and I'm like, sweet, right, and I'm done. It's more, in some ways, right, like anybody who comes from the sort of more Orthodox and Catholic traditions, and I don't, but this is what they tell me, and I believe them, is that it's really important that you're part of this tradition and community, and that is part of identifying as a member of that community, is you say, we believe.
Right.
And then you identify yourself. So you accept on testimony that doesn't, it goes, really sympathetic to what Peter was saying too, right? This doesn't squeeze out understanding. To some extent, it's sort of a precondition for understanding mm-hmm. in some religious traditions. Other ones obviously stress very much what you were in your paper, this idea about needing to find it on your own and having the right kind of foundation and the right kind of understanding. But it just struck me that it's way too simple to talk about, to, or at least that there's a lot more work to be done in the case of religious testimony in particular about the idea of communal knowledge and how individual people fit into this.
Yeah, really good. So I say something very quick toward the end of the paper about the importance of understanding at the individual level. I don't want to deny that there's an importance to understanding at the communal level as well, that you know, I get nothing of what I want in terms of having, you know, an appropriate grasp of a religious proposition from being in a community that communally understands, you know, by virtue of having in it maybe some mystics, maybe just people who are really different than me and have a different set of experiences, who communally understand some religious proposition. What I was focusing on in the paper was the individual level, because I was focusing on cases of sort of interpersonal testimony. But I guess I want to see the paper as just sort of being silent on whether there isn't a kind of additional layer that can be there and is part of what we want and is part of what we need. I think there's a core of, look, you've got to understand this for yourself and appreciate it to some extent. But you might get an additional sort of epistemic boost from being in a community that communally understands.
Right, so we have some follow-ups. Jennifer?
It's just a really quick follow-up. So I just wanted to, I think it's related to what Christina was saying. There are also some traditions where the kind of religious beliefs kind of bottom out in the authority of a text,
yeah.
Just bottoms out. Like, that's what it is. It's not like the justification of the text or something kind of then bottoms out with some perceptual experience. It's just the text is taken as sort of sacred.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's not clear to me that in some of these traditions, I mean, like Christina was saying, I mean, they might kind of think that just taking the authority of the text and trusting it just purely on the basis of the testimony of what's written is sort of like the end all be all, right? So it's just not clear to me that the claim you're extending to the religious domain would apply. I mean, it's just kind of following up.
Yeah, my amateur impression is that of all the traditions I know of, even where you've got a text that is just authoritative, full stop, there's some work to be done in interpretation and appreciating what it means. There's certainly some work to be done even on the individual level of a sort of affective or motivational response to what that text says. And so, you know, it's not as though we need to, you know, understand, you know, kind of evidential reasons for that every case of understanding evidential reasons is going to be sort of the primary thing that's needed. It might be more like appreciation of, reflection on, not just saying like, okay, yep, the text says it, got it, yep, the text says, you know. So it's more about, I think that there's room even in traditions that emphasize deference to, you know, an absolutely authoritative text. There's some room for getting at what I'm thinking understanding is.
Peter also.
Yeah, I was just on both points. It seems slightly orthogonal. One issue is, does the religion really go for understanding as a good in itself, or is it really about just here's the beliefs, that's what matters? And so you could really see some religions differing. So when you look at, and then there's the other issue about sort of individual versus collective. And so you could have, say, a religion that's all about belief, not about understanding. These are just the things we say, versus these are just the things I say. And another one that really emphasizes understanding, where it's what we understand or the individual that's important for understanding. So the Catholic case is interesting because for those who teach philosophy of religion, you've, especially in the States, you've almost always got kids who went to Catholic high schools. They're a minority, but they're in your classes, and there's the we believe. They're just pushing Aquinas at you like crazy. They have no understanding whatsoever. They just do not. Like, the very idea that there might be a reason for or against one of these things is like, oh, that makes them very uncomfortable. You're at the we believe stage, where it's a matter of identity in a group. It's playing that function. Where though in the what's important to Catholicism is that they reach this individual stage of understanding. That's why they're supposed to take philosophy classes in Jesuit universities and Catholic universities.
Jeff, do you want to do your belated follow-up?
Oh yeah, so I had a follow-up on Paulina's thing. And just thinking of trying to get the cases more current, another way to do that would be to take your non-moral, non-religious, you know, ordinary domain kind of thing, and take it to be something which is really interesting. Something that we care about the truth because, you know, it's a truth that we would like to know about. And I wonder if you get the same kind of intuitions about those kinds of cases, too. You know, say what Alex wants to know is whether the universe is infinite or finite. And somebody says, oh, yeah, it's finite. Or you know, whether land-dwelling creatures evolved once or multiple times, or whether the twin prime conjecture is true. I'm just wondering, do you get the same kind of feeling of defectiveness where you believe those things just on?
So the last thing I talked about, the idea of this being a general phenomenon, I mean, if Alex is, you know, a climate scientist and someone tells him, you know, the world's going to be covered in water by 2050, you know, that's something, even if this person is an expert, you might think that Alex ought not just to defer because of his role, possibly he ought also not just to defer without, you know, sort of caring or trying to understand what that means and why it's true, just because it's such an important proposition. But it's not moral and it's not religious, and I don't think that's a worry for my case because I don't have a background theory that, oh, you know, all moral and religious cases are going to be importantly different than anything that's not moral or religious. It's a good question, though, whether you can. I struggled a lot to get these cases parallel because, I mean, some things are so, especially moral truths, are so simple that it's just hard to think about people who don't know them without worrying about their moral fiber, you know, really generally, right? And I think that there's a lot of challenges in coming up with three cases that sound perfectly parallel, but I guess, you can imagine somebody, I think you can imagine somebody who really is interested in taxes, just interested in taxes, is fascinated by the tax system. They want to know how much they owe in taxes. And yet who asks, accepts, and just takes this as sort of an interesting fact, right? This is a really interesting fact. I think it's fascinating. I owe $500 this year or whatever. But doesn't sort of puzzle over it. And I don't get quite the same intuition as a person who says, wow, here's just this, you know, interesting fact. There's a God. Wow. but doesn't.
So I wonder if it makes a difference, though. There's one thing, which is to imagine somebody finding it interesting. There's another thing to consider a truth, which is interesting.
Mm.
So like those scientific cases or mathematical cases, whatever. Do you get the feeling on those ones, or do you not get it?
I think it's going to possibly depend on what they are.
So I gave you a few. What about those three?
whether the universe is finite or infinite.
That's right.
Is there a problem just to believe somebody about that without trying to understand?
Right.
So one thing that's going on in my head is I think there's a lot of people, perhaps myself included, who can't understand can only understand to some degree what I understand what finite is, and I understand what infinite is, but if you're trying to explain to me why, you know, I only have some degree of credence that I'll be able to follow that, depending on what the explanation then amounts to. Is it problematic just to believe that? I don't think so. I don't get it as strongly, unless, I don't get it as strongly in that case. I don't know.
So we have kind of a long queue, so if it's all right as we follow up on this later, is that right? So
sure.
Allison had one more follow-up on this point, and then...
Okay, this is going to be really quick.
Yeah.
I think one of the differences may be just the difference in how you think people should be motivated about these things. So, I mean, I'm very sympathetic to your idea. You can get understanding of all these different subjects and under the right circumstances, but people might want that or seek that rather than knowledge or in addition to knowledge. But in ethics, it's really important to do. And there's something wrong if you're not. Whereas, you know, lots of people will be very interested to hear about the universe, or, you know, as a lovely example, you're sitting at Stanford Wiles building whether Fermat's last theorem is true. And some people want to understand why as well. But it's like, it's not something wrong with you if you're just interested in the truth. And you want the knowledge, and you're going to go and ask Andrew whether he did prove it or not. And that's this. So there's a difference in the kind of status of understanding in morality, I think, in some of these other fields. But, you know, roles, or just because you're very interested in the subject, you can certainly aim for it instead yourself.
Yeah, I like that. I think that's very helpful. And thinking about, yeah, how to understand the defect when understanding isn't there. So if you've got a case where you think understanding is really important and it's the aim of belief in this particular instance, and it's not reached, in the moral case, you know, it seems pretty straightforward to call that a moral defect. It's a moral problem. And in the religious case, maybe we can call it a kind of religious problem, but it's not clear to me, you know, what to call it when I fail to understand a position in epistemology that I accept. And we might think that the defects differ across cases.
So back to the hands, Sandy.
So thanks, Laura and Peter, for a really nice discussion. For two quick comments, I invite your thoughts on this. One, I want to support something that Peter said with an example. I'm taken by Peter's idea that oftentimes in teaching, testimony is actually the basis for a kind of scaffolding. When I took logic in grad school, I had a logician who would often state things, and he would state things precisely when we were unsure which way the proof would go. And he would state things for us to, oh no, the proof won't go that way because I know this is true, because he said so. That actually is not screening out knowledge or squeezing knowledge. It's actually understanding. It's inviting understanding.
Yeah.
And the second point is, I thought also a lot about philosophy and whether we take testimony. I used to agree with you, but now I think there's a modified sense in which we do take testimony in philosophy. But let me throw this at you and see what you think about this.
It'll speak to your moral character.
That's true. So I come up with this new thought on testimony, and I'm really excited about it. I'm sitting in my office. This is great. And I'm figuring if I'm going to devote a lot of time to this, I want to know whether or not this stands a decent chance of success. Happily for me, I have a colleague who's a world-class epistemologist of testimony. I go down the hall, I knock on the door, lackey's in, I say, Jennifer, here's my idea, what do you think? She says, Sandy, there are three concerns I would have if I were you. Here they are. Now, it could be the case that I don't fully understand what the concerns are yet, but I know she's a pretty good epistemologist, and I say, okay, I have more thinking to do.
Yeah.
That's a way in which I do think we take a kind of testimony, even in philosophy.
Yeah, it could. That all seems right to me. So, the squeezing out tendency and the scaffolding tendency, I won't accept that testimony can be a scaffold for further knowledge. I think it's, you know, even in the moral case, it seems clear if you think about moral learning for children. It's very plausible that children just have to be told, what fairness is. And there may be some natural capacities there that just get coached, Possibly, there's a lot of just real telling, and hopefully some accepting in the development process. So, I'll have to think more about how to classify. It's not a straightforward story that testimony squeezes out understanding, because I think it can sometimes be a scaffold or even a trigger, right? So, in a particular case, not just a developmental thing. If I tell you something that's interesting and you accept it, you might be independently, because of other things you believe or other dispositions you have, you might be independently motivated to go on and search for understanding of that and come to it because I've told you you've accepted it. So I think...
Doesn't that support Peter's point that it's not the testimony but what the person does with it? Where you want the norms?
Yeah, so I do put the norm on the paper at the level of the problem is with non-understanding belief or non-understanding knowledge, right? That's where the problem is. And the reason this is linked to testimony, the reason that this can help explain kind of pessimist intuitions about moral testimony, is that testimony has the capacity, maybe I want to say that, testimony has the capacity to squeeze out understanding, right? And I think if you think about... If you make it a more circumscribed question, so think about moral learning for adults. So they've gone through the whole step of being kids and just being told what's fair and what's not fair. And now, think about adults taking testimony on understanding. This isn't, a sort of class, a logic class kind of thing. I think the idea is that non-understanding testimony as an adult in a moral question is just not the kind of thing, the scaffold has been built. This could be a trigger for you for further sort of cognitive and effective work, but in general, it's not a good safe method to use to arrive, safe used in an untechnical sense. It's not a good safe method used to arrive at understanding, and so we really ought to be looking more to things that are more surefire, like reflection in response to reasons in the environment.
So Paulina has a quick follow-up.
Just a very, very quick, I guess it's not clear, the squeezing out language, I object to it. What I hear you saying is testimony sometimes interferes with some good stuff, right? So like understanding, but it seems there's nothing unique about testimony here. If you're really bad at moral reflection, then moral reflection will with your, it's just like taking the stairs, taking the elevator always can interfere with you getting fit, but taking the stairs too much can like lead to hip injuries, and that will also make you unfit. So I guess I just don't see anything distinct at this point about testimony.
Yeah, the reason I maintain that there is something distinct about testimony, even though I want to place the norm at the level of non-understanding belief for knowledge, or for moral propositions, the reason I think there's still something unique about testimony is that you know, even though this is the primary norm, right, have understanding along with your moral knowledge. You might think that there's a derivative norm, something like do your best to understand the moral beliefs that you have, right? And somebody who's really bad at moral reflection could satisfy that derivative norm. And we might think that that's kind of an important, you know, even though it's a derivative norm, it's kind of important. It's kind of important to do your best to understand the moral beliefs you have. And pure deference to testimony, again, this is kind of the, you know, just, oh, what is lying by omission wrong? Oh, okay, sure. That's not a way of, it's not even a way of satisfying the derivative norm. And I think in the space of sort of methods available for moral learning, testimony seems to be the one, you know, that's most clearly, not abstracting from sort of oracles and magic pills, it seems to be the one that gets us to non-understanding moral knowledge and kind of to stand alone in that place.
Okay, so let's make sure we get through our hands now. Charity is next.
Okay, so just actually one point on this subject and I'll ask my question. So another reason to think that maybe testimony is not unique in this respect is that I think our other sources of knowledge will have the same result in a lot of cases. So say that I understand and have all the right, you know, emotional responses to a certain moral truth, and then a couple years later, I lose those emotional responses, I forget all of the reasons, but I remember that I came to the conclusion that something was wrong. So now I have this belief that isn't an important sense based in memory, but it lacks all of the extra things that you want that are lacking in the case of testimony. I think you can do the same maybe with moral perception. Like if you're, you know, depending on how you understand moral perception, I might see something clearly enough to see that something's wrong, but not really have any emotional response that goes with it, or any understanding of reasons, and yet I came to it through a kind of moral perception. So I think that might be worth thinking about in relation to whether testimony is unique in this respect. But my question is, I want to push you on what is the defect that you're trying to criticize an agent who comes to religious knowledge or religious belief or moral belief on the basis of testimony. Mm-hmm. So one way that I was understanding your paper is you could think like this. Well, the ideal agent would have understanding and all of these extra things. And so you can get knowledge, but it would be better if you had all of this other reasons and things like that. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering what that really amounts to. So one question I have is like, do you think the subject is criticizable if they fail to be ideal in that sense? Or are you thinking, well, no, they could be doing better. And I think there's a worry that if all we're saying is, well, they could be doing better, then we can say that about a lot of different things, especially in areas where we wouldn't actually criticize the person. So, I mean, in the tax case, you know, they would be doing better in some sense, epistemically, if they understood, they would have more knowledge, you know. But we don't criticize them for not understanding the tax code perfectly. So I'm wondering what this epistemic ideal agent might look like. I mean, are they omniscient? You know, you don't want to criticize people for not being omniscient. So I think that there's a little bit more to say there. And sorry, I know this is long, but let me just say two other things. So in the moral case, I think that there are definitely instances where we can accept moral testimony without criticism. So in really specific areas where we just don't have time to gather all the facts, and maybe we also have no action that we're about to do. Maybe, you know, someone who works in a certain domain, maybe in like the military, they say, oh, this is wrong in this context of war or something, and I take their word for it. But there's no like motivation for me to pursue understanding of that. I'm never going to be in that situation.
Yeah.
And I don't think we get the sense in that case that I'm defective for not pursuing understanding. So that's the moral case. In the religious case, I think there are some facts that I don't really know what it would mean to understanding about. Some facts, maybe you're not thinking these are religious facts or religious, you know, the type of thing that you're going for, but I mean there's some historical facts like Jesus was born in Nazareth or from Nazareth. You know, that I mean what would it even mean to have understanding of those facts? And what would it be to come to them by any way other than testimony? So anyway, sorry, I know that was a lot.
No, it's all really good. It's all really good. Yeah, I really like the question about forgetting. That does seem to me like a way that you can arrive at not understanding moral knowledge of the kind that I'm saying is, you know, the root of the problem that's not via testimony. That seems like a really good counterexample to the idea that testimony is the only way to get to the state that I'm saying is bad. Yeah, so I think I would be committed to saying, you know, testimony might be the standard way or all standard way, but in general, it's the end state that's that. So good. The ideal cognitive agent. So I reference an ideal agent in order to kind of motivate this idea that a moral problem with your cognitive state could engender an epistemic problem with your cognitive state. And my thought there was just along the lines of, well, if we think about what we really want cognitively, we don't just want, you know, knowledge of any old truths. We want sort of knowledge of important and interesting truths. And surely moral propositions are among the, I'm using knowledge talk, I don't mean to be. We want to have the right grasp of important and interesting truths, and surely moral truths are among that, and whatever grasp we have of them, we want that grasp to enable sort of moral life and enable us to be good moral agents. I don't want to say that the reason that was the ideal agent was kind of a thought exercise bit to get our heads wrapped around, to get my head wrapped around why a moral problem would engender an epistemic problem. But I don't want to say that the epistemic problem in a case of non-understanding moral knowledge is that you're not ideal. What I want to say is that you are criticizable. And I want to follow a kind of, you know, belief aims at sort of picture. So you might, starting with an idea of, you know, what we want out of our cognition and an ideal cognitive agent, I think then we get to this idea that, well, you know, so belief in, you know, the amount that I owe in taxes might aim at knowledge or just truth or whatever, but actually to get it right in my moral beliefs, what I'm aiming at is understanding. And so when I don't hit that, I'm criticizable, insofar as I'm not getting what the kind of cognitive grip that I need on that kind of proposition. You asked about specific moral questions, and you referenced ones where a lot of specialized knowledge might be needed in order to see a moral truth, and also ones where it's not going to be practically relevant for me. I think it's hard to separate out non-moral information and moral. So I might need to know a lot about a war and a lot about, you know, maybe the history of war and just war theory and stuff in order to see that a particular, action of torture or holding hostage or whatever is permissible or wrong. And that's a lot of, that includes at least a lot of non-moral information, right? And so if it's a case where I have to make a moral judgment, I might well defer to somebody who has more, you know, non-moral information about the case that they can't plausibly or practically convey to me so that I can make my own moral judgment about the situation. I think that happens, but I don't think it's a straightforward sort of deference on the moral issue, and I don't think that's very easy to isolate in cases like that. I do want to say that, so you might be criticizable for having non-understanding moral knowledge, but certainly you can be excused for that, and you can be excused for that by, you know, something like needing it urgently for action, or by it being, you know, really, really difficult. Maybe just four theory is really hard. And maybe, you know, this is the kind of thing that I'm not going to be facing all of the time, and so I can't be held to, you know, even though I'm criticizable because I'm holding a moral belief that I don't understand, well, you know, criticizable for lots of reasons, and we can kind of be excused for by the sheer difficulty of the case. You also ask about specific religious facts, that it's hard to see what understanding would mean, and yeah, I think that, you know, there's a lot of different religious propositions are not a very clear class here. You know, there's things like there is a God, this is the body of Christ broken for you, and then there's things like, well, you know, Jesus was born in Nazareth, and I think all I want to defend is that there's some class of propositions that are, you know, within the lump that we might think of intuitively as religious, where this is important.
Okay, so to get to everybody, can we've got about 25 minutes. Ask your best question. Mikkel.
Yeah, I thought you were right than your critics insofar as there is a special obligation of the testifier in those domains. So I just want to try to maybe reconstruct a little bit and see whether you think it's a fair reconstruction. So on the squeezing out point, I took it to be making an existential point rather than a universal one. So people come up with cases where, you know, oh, it's an enabling condition and so on and so forth. But all you need is that there's a subset of cases where if you present a moral or religious truth as if it were a trivial truth, then psychologically that will discourage understanding. Right? That's all you need, and that's plausible that there's some such six cases for that. Okay, do those cases, restricting us up to them, that special norm on the testifier as well as on the agent, right? And I don't think you should cave on the norm of the testifier bit here, right? But I don't think it needs to be a special norm. So it's perfectly straightforward in the norm of assertion stuff, the idea that context and domain can determine the epistemic demands on the testifier. So that extends very naturally to the idea that domain can generate special obligations on the testifier, right? So it's not really, you don't have to postulate a special norm, it kind of falls out of ordinary norms of assertion, and then you might want to think a little bit about what it might be, if that's the route you want to take. And a natural thing is just to look at our practice, right? So it seems like good more testimony to kids and stuff like that. You say, you know, you can't take a drawing, and then sometimes you'll accompany that by some indication that this is an instance of a principle, right? So golden rule kind of assertions is, how would you feel if she did that to you or something like that? People very often do that, and if you plug that into your initial cases, the discomfort kind of goes away a little bit, because the special obligation that falls out of the ordinary norm might be an obligation on the testifier to indicate that this is not a trivial truth, but this is something that's worthy of reflection, an instance of a principle, something like that. And that seems perfectly compatible with Peter's point that sometimes in the moral development of a person there has to be some, because I say so, assertions as sort of an enabling condition, right? So is that, is that a route for you to go, or am I missing something?
So I don't talk about norms for testifiers in this paper.
Right.
And to be honest, I haven't thought...
But you're talking about a special norm for those testimonies, right?
I talk about a special norm for the belief, and I'm thinking about the beliefs that are formed on the basis of testimony. So I'm really just thinking about the receipt. But this might connect to sort of Peter's thoughts at the end about education, right? We might think that there are... norms, or at least better and worse ways of presenting things that we want people to understand. And so, it's plausible that if there is this norm I'm talking about that you ought to understand the moral beliefs you hold, then when you're telling people, you know, trying to give moral advice, that you give it, hopefully, in ways that encourage critical reflection.
Right. So maybe the discomfort. This is the suggestion, right? Maybe the discomfort about the mole and maybe also the relations case is actually not on the testifier. If the case is specified so that she's not in a position to take it as anything but a trivial truth if it's presented like that. So maybe the intuitions about the recipients is really driven by a failure on part of the testifier in the cases, right? So at least you might want to think about that.
Yeah, that's really interesting. You might think that they're both criticizable or...
Yeah, those are two cases.
Jennifer.
A version of my question's already been asked, so I'll pass.
Okay. Laura.
So I was, like Charity, thinking about memory as a case of source of knowledge without understanding. And then I was also thinking that thinking about analogous cases involving memory can maybe help tell us exactly what's wrong with relying on others' testimony. And I think some of this is speculative because, you know, who knows if my intuitions about cases are at all like other people's, but I think maybe we can get 2 points from this. And one is that in the moral case is actually importantly different than the religious case here. So it seems like in the moral case, once I've, I was figuring out like what stuff is moral to eat. Like I settled on it's okay to eat fish, it's not okay to eat chicken. Like I no longer, you know, maybe really strongly can reconstruct my reasons, but it seems fine. That it seems like I don't have to. And the reason for that is because I, you know, the norm about, moral understanding has to do with like making sure some sort of autonomy thing, like you've accepted these principles for themselves or for yourself. It seems worse to me in the religious case if I forget my reasons. So at least that's just, you know, like reporting my own intuitions, this seems to be a case in which the moral and the religious case come apart. Mm-hmm. And then maybe another lesson is that this at least pulls against the idea that Peter was pushing, that what's objectionable is the failure to strive to understand. Because I think, so just take the boring case where it's not about morality or religion. Take something like, I went through the trouble of like reading through Gödel's incompleteness theorem. Like now I kind of forget what it says. Like I have no, but I know it's true. Seems like I have no obligation to, like, you know, I've already done my duty with respect to it. Like, nonetheless, if I go through it again and, you know, again, like, gain the understanding now, it seems like I've, that seems valuable. So, and I think if the failure were to strive to understand, then you sort of, there are two versions of that failure. There's like a diachronic version and a synchronic version. But none of them, but if it was like I had to at some point have understood it, then I would, it wouldn't be a positive to go back and understand it now, but it is. And if it's a synchronic norm, like it's a, I need to strive to understand at a time, then I actually would be failing now by, then it would be false that I have no obligation to think about it now. So I think our sort of particular, the way in which what we think we have obligations to do and what we think we've gained with respect to like a boring fact that we forget our understanding about kind of pushes against that point.
Yeah, good. So I worry that different religious traditions and different religious people might think differently about whether, you know, thinking through something at one point and sort of, you know, okay, so I did my, you know, first communion kind of training, you know, I thought about this all at one point, you know, I don't have to keep thinking about it all the time. You know, it's kind of enough that I maintain some level of, you know, meditative, affective understanding that enacts itself in dispositions. And it's not clear to me that that sort of understanding something at one time but later forgetting it does you no good in the religious case. I'm just not sure what to say. I'm not sure that there's a concrete, there's a really clear cut sort of, okay, this is helpful in the moral case, but not in the religious case. And it seems, you know, plausible to me that if I asked a bunch of religious people, they would give me kind of different answers. So it's a good case to think about.
That sounds right, yeah.
Okay.
Turn my question to a follow-up in a way. So Charity and Laura talked about memory, and that got me wondering about perception. And suppose I perceive a bloody knife on the floor, and what looks like a note scrawled by it in blood. So I come to know that there's a bloody knife there, and what looks like a note by it. But I don't wonder why that is. I don't seek to understand why isn't there's a knife there, like bloody knife there laying on the floor. That seems wrong. And so it seems like perceptual knowledge squeezes out understanding. You can do this for hearing, you know. You hear Obama hates you, but you don't wonder why. So I'm just wondering if that seems weird. Their questions just got me wondering if their concerns could be extended even farther through modes of getting knowledge, like, you know, perception and hearing, and maybe it generalizes. Just one.
I mean, I've been thinking about moral and religious truths, right? And I think there's kind of, let's think about moral truths for a minute. In a sense, some people want to say that you perceptually can see moral truths. I'm thinking of somebody like McDowell, who thinks of virtue as kind of perception, right? But that kind of perception is like responsiveness to moral facts or moral reason. I mean, he thinks of that responsiveness almost on a perceptual model. Mm-hmm. You're just thinking of sort of seeing, you know, one person making a certain motion that will in the end result in the other, you know, another person's being injured, right? We're just talking about visual perception. It's difficult.
Well, maybe it falls back to the question of, you seem to be making a distinction between different kinds of propositions. Like there are, some people think there are religious propositions and non-religious propositions. So, and you definitely use the phrase, you know, religious knowledge and non-religious knowledge and non-knowledge.
Yeah.
And I worry that there's no good way of drawing these distinctions. That something like Tillich is right, that what's religious is a matter of ultimate commitment. There's no such thing as any content. And clearly, that there's a God is not a religious proposition. I mean, the deists were utterly non-religious. Aristotle was utterly non-religious. And they were all, there was a divine being. So maybe my question is just a way of querying, what is this distinction in the first place? I mean, if I see somebody cross themselves, if I see somebody bow down to a tree in the posture that we call the worship posture, am I visually seeing a religious... Am I coming to know religious proposition that way, or?
So your question is about whether we can categorize, or how we can categorize propositions as
religious or not.
Is it religious or not, or is it, you know, those that where we would need understanding or not?
Well, you can do it either way, right? I mean, I think this sort of situation can be used to raise problems for both of the positions. So you can pick whichever one is most interesting to you. I think these issues cut across both those lines.
Yeah, I'm not sure that I'm understanding. So,
okay, what is religious knowledge? What makes something not a religious knowledge? That's my question. Versus a non.
Quick, one sentence.
I'm just trying to ask it.
Yeah, and I'm not going to have a super deep answer, because I just want to say knowledge of a proposition that has religious content, and I know that you don't like that, you might think that there is, you know, just like it's hard to define what has more, you know, is it is the sentence that, you know, is the proposition that somebody's kind, is that a moral proposition? Is the proposition that somebody's suffering or that they're in pain, is that a moral proposition? I mean,
well,
more they're hard to
moral
define.
Properties. There's a whole literature on moral properties. I don't think there's anything like religious properties.
We're going to let Laura respond to that and then rebut with the next one.
I'm definitely not going to have a good response.
Okay. We'll continue that one later.
Okay,
Tim.
Please.
Okay. So, Laura, I'm wondering whether you really, in the end, think that there's just one general norm, or maybe that there are plurality that might be circumstance-specific, and I'd like you to clarify what is its or their source. So one might think that there is a norm for the pursuit of understanding in religion that's independent of the truth of any particular religious claim. So it's a kind of a norm qua human beings with our distinctive aims that we all share and sort of general abilities. So even a non-religious person has an obligation to kind of be reflective of a non-religious conceptual on the world. Or you might think, additionally, or separately, you might think that it flows, and this was coming out in some earlier discussion, in part from a person's having accepted a specific set of religious claims that enjoin the pursuit of understanding. Or you might think it flows from the truth of some religious claims. So that is, if God exists, and God, you know, desire has created human beings with capacities, you know, and desires, you know, Christian teaching, saved in this sort of way. There's this duty, God-given duty, to pursue understanding of God and God's revelation. You know, so someone might think, yeah, if God exists, there is such a norm, plausibly. But if God doesn't exist, and the kind of unreflective, kind of, you know, superficial, you know, professing Christian, it's just kind of a harmless social activity they like to engage in. They don't like to think about it too much. They don't want to occupy too much of their time in life. It's kind of harmless, you know? So anyways, are you really wanting to say, look, it's this more general beauty on all of us? Or is it kind of flow for the believing person they ought to take to themselves to do intercession?
Yeah, this is a really good question. And I'll give a first pass answer, but I'd like to think more about it. I'm inclined to say that structurally, something like the general norm, the first thing. So qua human being, we ought to be striving for this kind of understanding. But I think that it may actually look, you know, within the, you know, qua human being umbrella, it may actually be a hypothetical. So qua human being, if there is a God, you know, if there is anything to religion, you ought to try to understand it. Something along those lines, where it's perfectly possible to be a human being, to have, you know, looked for religious understanding. To some extent, it's going to depend on what we think, you know, religious propositions are, because you might think that we can have a lot of, you know, you can have religious understanding of the fact that there is no God, but these other things are important, and this is why, you know, taking religion to be more of a positive claim about, you know, there being a story that looks like sort of standard world religions. You might think that, you know, qua human being, I could satisfy my duty to sort of look for such religious understanding, but thinking that there, you know, satisfying myself that there is none, I've then sort of satisfied the general duty.
Max, Tim already asked a question.
Peter.
Allison made a comment that triggered my memory, more memory of Locke, and it goes to some of the other questions that have been asked. So, in taking from Tim, the kind of in general, there are goods and there are means to those goods. So if God exists, and of course, if God commands understanding, it's going to be very good for us to understand. But if God doesn't, then. In Locke, I made that remark about that famous passage where he says you can't get knowledge from the word of others. Now, he distinguishes between the word of others, this is a common phrase throughout the essay, and then in book four, from testimony. So testimony is one of the sources of probable opinion. So he's against the word of others throughout the book. Well, in book one, that passage
comes at the end of the polemic against innate ideas. Mm. And most philosophers read the polemic as a polemic with Descartes, and of course it was responded to by Leibniz. But John Yolton, the Rutgers historian of Locke, wrote a book on this issue where he thought the main target in book one was pamphleteers who were arguing for various doctrines, in particular Catholic doctrines, in metaphysics and in religion, and they were claiming that all of these doctrines were innate ideas. And because they're innate ideas, you sort of know them already, and there's no need to reflect on them. But Locke was urging this sort of line that God has commanded us to understand, and he's given us the capacity to understand. In fact, to know, because moral and religious doctrines are all going to be analytic in his sense, and they're all things that, in fact, you could know, and that's why you've got to think for it for yourself. So it kind of goes to this general conception of sort of what's good and what are the means to it and what are the obstacles. So the it feels like the historical antecedent to this kind of view is really Locke's essay.
That's helpful. Thank you.
John?
It's just, if a moral belief is a belief encoded by moral concepts, then it seems to me there's no way there's a general norm against testimony for those, or a general thing that I'm interested in them, or a general thing that I want understanding of them, because just so many beliefs like that are very little interesting. I mean, if someone tells me, someone I don't much care about, that they're in jail for defrauding so-and-so, or brutally, you know, attacking so-and-so, that's a moral proposition. It's completely unproblematic getting it by testimony. I mean, I won't think that well of the person, but I won't care that much. And, you know, I mean, I just can't get into the frame of mind at all of thinking there's a general maxim for moral propositions if they're construed that way.
Yeah, good. I mean, you might think that there are, it seems obvious to me that there are moral propositions as trivial as the 323rd entry in the Wichita, Kansas phone book, right? If we're thinking of specific moral, you know, so-and-so did a wrong thing on 9 in the morning.
Yeah.
I think that...
I mean, obviously you want a circumscribed notion of not moral belief, I'm just wondering what it would be.
Yeah. I have a couple thoughts, and I'm not sure exactly which one's right, so I'll say in both. One is just to follow up on this idea of, well, what we really want to understand are the important moral beliefs, the moral beliefs that it's important for us to hold. So some general set of flexible moral principles that are maybe important in general to human lives and human virtue, and maybe specifically important to the role that I lead. And there's specific moral judgments that I actually need to make. So that's, I think that's maybe how I want to go. But I also think that this idea of a derivative norm, you ought to understand the moral beliefs you have, is fairly important. I mean, if I...
Were moral beliefs understood my way?
Yeah, if it's a, you know, sort of proposition, I'm not... Like, because clearly you could have a trivial belief where it's difficult to get in the frame of mind that it's problematic just because you have it and don't understand it.
Well, there's a thing Charity said earlier about, you know, very particular things. It's a bit funny to ask what the reason is. I mean, there are all sorts of propositions encoded by moral concepts you wouldn't ask.
Yeah, right.
It would just be a lot funnier asking what the reasons are.
Yeah, I guess I probably just want to go with the sort of, you know, well, it's radically contextual based, you know, it's what's important for you, it's what's important for you to understand.
Right.
I mean, you could also think that you're excused from understanding certain moral beliefs because of their irrelevance to your actual situation. I'm not sure exactly how I want to go.
Can I just put myself at the,
yeah,
at the end? I'm just thinking, if you're going to grant that in a domain it's okay to believe based on memory where you forgot the proof or whatever the thing that happened before, So like, you know, I went through all the reasoning before. I forget the reasoning, but I keep the memory that I keep the memory that was the, in the belief that was the product of that reasoning. It's okay to keep that belief on the basis of memory. There's going to be an argument that it's okay to believe some stuff on the basis of testimony in that domain. So imagine I go through the reasoning process and form belief. They duplicate me. They make a duplicate of me. And then I forget everything. But they can like learn, but then the duplicate testifies to the belief. It seems like if it's okay to believe the memory, it's okay to believe the duplicate. If you know it's the duplicate, basically. it's just something to think about. You don't have to say it. It's like some testimonies, okay. It's a conditional thing, too, if the memory was okay.
Yeah. No, it's really interesting. So one thing to say in favor of this idea that, understanding and then forgetting all but the knowledge bit is actually different, at least in the moral case. If you think that moral understanding is an important part of moral agency, and if you think that moral agency is a thing that sort of extends through time, right? So it can be beneficial to my moral agency now that I once did this one thing, and sort of moral worth can accrue to an agent in ways that sort of stick over time. You might think that understanding and then forgetting is important and different than the never understanding.
All right, so let's thank our speaker, Dan.